This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Josh Doody, author of Fearless Salary Negotiation and a Salary Negotiation Coach. Thank you for taking time to join me, Josh.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. Looking forward to chatting.
To start, can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Sure. I actually began long before now as a computer and electrical engineer. I studied at the University of Florida here in Gainesville, Florida. Go Gators. And then began my career working for a really large Department of Defense firm in test engineering on the electrical engineering side. Did that for a couple of years and just wasn't my cup of tea. Specifically, I had a really good sense of what the career path looked like from there. And while it was very stable and predictable, it wasn't very interesting. And I didn't feel like there was a lot of interesting upside for me in sort of agency that I would have over my career. And so I made kind of an abrupt pivot after 2 or 3 years and went from essentially electrical engineering at a giant Department of Defense firm to project management and consulting at a 30-person software company, and completely switched so that I could be more client-facing. And I also wanted to get a much better sense of what does it look like to run a business. I could tell even early on that I eventually would want to probably run my own business. So I switched, went to work for a small software company in the talent development space, which sort of brings me closer to where I am now. The talent development industry, which didn't really exist back then. It was all piecemeal back then, but now there are companies that do everything. That industry is for evaluating employee performance, helping employees set goals, succession planning and career planning, and compensation management, which gave me a great opportunity to consult with companies on how they pay people. So how do they structure their salaries? How do they give out raises and bonuses and equity and all that good stuff? And so through that consultation, I got more and more experience in the industry. Spent almost 10 years in that industry, and then eventually left there to publish my book, Fearless Salary Negotiation. That was now about 18 months ago, and here I am now. As you know, I wrote the book, I now coach people, and am constantly trying to create new content and just provide value to help people take agency over their own careers like I did early on as much as possible. So that's my story.
Salary negotiation coach, what is it? What do you do?
You know, it's interesting because if you asked me that question a year ago, I think I would have believed that there was a really nice, concise answer to that question. But it turns out that every person is different. And so in general, what I do is I usually start working with people when they're beginning the interview process with a couple of companies or one company that they really want to get a job at. I help them focus on their positioning so that they can stand out in their interviews as the candidate for the job. To help convince the company to make them an offer. And then once they get that offer, I walk them through the negotiation process through a combination of tactics, sort of behind the scenes help. So I will literally help them script emails and communications with the company that they're negotiating with. So essentially I'm negotiating for them by proxy behind the scenes. And then also a combination of encouragement, which is the part that I didn't see coming, which is just helping people understand that, listen, I've done this a lot of times before with a lot of big companies. I know how the process works. I've consulted on the other side of the table. I've been a hiring manager. So you have to trust me. So when they say, I don't know, I'm not comfortable doing that, then I switch from, you know, tactical engineering type advice to, you just have to trust me. Here's why. Do this, and this is how they will respond. And after a few of those iterations where the response that comes back is very much in line with what I kind of predicted, then they'll trust me more and we can move a little bit faster. So it's a combination of tactics, behind the scenes, you know, by proxy negotiation, and then also just sort of encouragement and literal coaching to keep making progress and moving forward.
So you don't represent the person, it sounds like. You said you're proxying, you're helping with the emails. Has anyone asked you to just negotiate on their behalf?
No one has asked me that yet. The closest I've gotten is a CEO of a very small startup in Silicon Valley was selling his company to somebody else. And although he didn't ask me to negotiate on his behalf, he asked me to tell him exactly how to negotiate, which is a little different than my typical sort of setup. But so far, I've not had anyone ask me to negotiate on their behalf, which I kind of prefer. I would be fine negotiating on someone's behalf, but I think that my clients actually benefit quite a bit from the fact that they're negotiating like an expert, like me, without the company knowing that's what they're doing. And I think it makes the company a little bit less sort of on guard and gives my clients more of an opportunity to negotiate on their own, but with an expert backing them. And I think that's a benefit for them. So I think the results are probably better if the companies don't know I'm involved.
If a person was interested in working with you, would you, when you hear of things like these coaches, professional coaches, life coaches, et cetera, you think it has to be a really, really high salary. How would you respond to that?
It depends. So sometimes that's true. My fee is, it's not cheap to work with me, but I've also set up my business so that if you look at my fee for one-on-one sort of personal coaching and you say, well, I just can't afford that. Usually that's an indication that, like you said, maybe you're not currently in a salary bracket where you can get enough ROI to justify that investment, at least explicitly, right? So I could spend time arguing that, well, even if my fee won't be recovered in salary, I'm teaching you how to use positioning to interview better, and that is on its own is valuable. But I also offer, for example, just a one-hour strategy session at a much lower price point. And I offer my book with video lessons at a lower price point, and then my book with no video lessons at an even lower price point. And so I try to offer something that everybody can take advantage of. Part of that is me trying to run a business, and part of that is I recognize that some people simply can't afford to pay me directly to work on me one-on-one. They can't afford to buy my time, basically, and my expertise one-on-one. And I want to make sure that they get something. I don't want to just only offer that top option. So I've set my business up so that if you are interested in my expertise, that you can access my expertise at some level, regardless of your income level.
We're going to kind of go through roughly the structure of the book in this podcast. So this will give people an idea of what they would get if they were to purchase it. And it's available on various things like Amazon, I suppose, and regular bookstores.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. And then also I sell through my own site. So most of what I just mentioned, I sell at fearlesssalarynegotiation.com. But my book is also on Amazon and does pretty well there. So that's the easiest way to find it there. And then you can also buy it directly from me.
So we're going to kind of, as I say, we're going to go through roughly the structure of it, because it makes perfect sense for a person looking for a job anyway. And the first thing you cover are pay structures. So that's often something that a person in a company or even someone looking to join a company wouldn't even be aware of.
Right. I think that's true. And to be honest, I really struggled with where to put the pay structures information in the book. You, as you mentioned, noticed that it's chapter one. I lead with pay structures, which is, I think, kind of an odd choice if you don't know much about salary negotiation. I actually wrote the book initially to put that into an appendix. I pulled it out because I do think it's a very, very short chapter. And I think if you read that chapter and you understand how companies manage their salary structures, it's sort of, there's maybe a light bulb moment for you where you say, oh, and then maybe if you've got a few years of experience in your career, you'll immediately understand why you had that conversation with your manager where they said that thing that sounded, you know, cryptic at the time, but now it makes sense because you understand the salary structures. So at the high level, salary structures are just how companies, especially larger companies, build structures to help them decide how much to pay people. And it's usually what's called a pay range or a pay band or a salary range. So it's, you know, for this job or group of jobs, what's the minimum salary that will pay somebody to do one of those jobs? And what's the maximum salary that will pay somebody to do those jobs? And what that does is it enables the company to not be totally random in what they're paying people. And it gives them a structure, a little structure, you know, that looks on paper, it looks like kind of a set of stairs where you've got, you know, the bottom tier job at the lower end of the salary that goes from a small salary to a slightly less small salary. The next job up is the next step up on the staircase, and that band is a little bit higher in salary and on up. And so it's just a way of companies giving themselves a structure to work with to avoid randomness in how they pay. And the reason it matters to employees is if you're getting near the top of what I call your pay grade, if you're near the maximum of what they can pay you to do your current job, you're going to really struggle to continue to get raises in that pay grade and may not even be able to do it. And so that sends signals to you that you need to, instead of pursuing a raise in dollars, need to pursue more responsibility, as in a promotion, to move up to the next step on that staircase. And this can also inform the way that you would negotiate against a company where you don't know what their staircase looks like, where you don't know their structures. You can still use tactics, which is the rest of my book, to sort of discern what the staircase might look like if you could kind of sketch it out. You know, it's almost like you're feeling around in the dark and you kind of get a sense of the contours of it through negotiation tactics. So that's why I lead with it and why it's useful and why the chapter is so short is I want to give you enough information that you say, okay, well, I pretty much get this, but, you know, it's not, you know, 20,000 words on on salary structures. I certainly wouldn't read that, and I don't think most other people would either.
Do you find that companies will use this as a tool against employees? a way of saying, well, look, you're a junior dev and you can't have more than this, despite the fact that you work 60 hours and you're brilliant or whatever it happens to be?
I think kind of. I would say my direct answer to your question would be no. I don't think that they use it against. I think what happens with pay structures is, because of that handy dandy structure that they can fall back on, that employers use it as more of a crutch than any kind of a weapon or anything. And so it's easier for a manager to say, I'd like to get you a raise, but you already bumped into the top of your pay grade. I know you're working a lot, but your title is junior developer, and the most that we can pay a junior developer is $65,000. So I'm sorry, I can't help you. But that's because it's easy for them to say that. And even what I just said, hopefully in your listeners' minds, it rang some bells and they said, well, wait a minute. Maybe if I want to get paid more and I think I'm worth more, maybe I'm not a junior developer, right? That's what you should be thinking is, maybe I'm not a junior developer. And then you go back to your manager and say, I understand everything you said. Let's talk about that next level up for my development career. How do I get there so that I can earn more money, right? So I don't think that they use it against people. I think it's just sort of, it's a lazy thing that they can use and say, well, sorry, I can't help you right now. I've got other stuff to do.
With that background in mind, let's take a hypothetical person who's preparing to go for a new job interview. The first step that you suggest they take is to estimate their market value.
That's right. I think it's really important to do this early, and this is why it's, I like the way that you're just kind of walking through the book, almost through the table of contents. Estimating your market value is an important step because it will, first of all, it give you a sense of what your expectations should look like. So when we talk about salary negotiation, I think that people have a tendency to kind of think that there's some sort of magic wand that can be waved that will hypnotize a company into paying you twice what they would pay otherwise, and that's just not the case. The reality is it's a value conversation, and you want to go into that conversation as educated as possible. And so the company probably already has a salary structure. They already know about what they're willing to pay, bottom and top, for the role that you've applied for, and it will help you to negotiate better if you go in with similar information, which you're probably not going to find the company salary structure, but you could find examples of people who do a similar job at that company, like on Glassdoor.com or other companies in the industry, to get a sense of what that pay range for your role would look like. That helps you to go into the negotiation with a more reasonable set of expectations, but will also help with something that I think we'll discuss later, which is setting your minimum acceptable salary, which is sort of that bar where you say, I'm not going to take this job if I can't get this salary. That's informed by your market value research, which I think is a key component to asking for raises when you're at your current company, but also when you're changing jobs and looking to negotiate your starting salary.
And one of the things you talk about estimating your market value is honestly appraising your skills and what you have to offer in relation to others.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about that. And I think you and I differ slightly on this idea.
Sure. So I'll give a very quick, helicopter view of my strategy. And then I would love to hear, any suggestions or pushback that you have. I think that's an interesting conversation. So I think the way that I see it is sort of a funnel that has three layers. The first layer is the industry layer, which is just in general. So usually I'm talking about like a country market, so the US market or the European market. It's not a country, but an area where people kind of compete against each other and have similar skills and similar companies to apply to. So you start at, say, the US level, the US market. What does, you mentioned junior developer earlier, what does a junior developer that is comfortable with these technologies tend to make in the US? And the answer is, let's say $50,000 is what you find with that group of technologies. Now, immediately you can see that there are some problems with this because the US is a very big place, and working in New York or Silicon Valley or San Francisco is different than working where I live in Gainesville, Florida. If I made a San Francisco salary in Gainesville, Florida, I would be very, 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 very well off, right? And so that is only the first kind of layer, which is, what's the industry paying people that look like me and have my experience? The second layer is to narrow down geographically. So what do people who are in my area of the country or the area of the country where I'd like to get a job, what are they getting paid to do this job? And that might fluctuate up or down based on the information that you can find. And that's information that you can get instead of just sort of broadly on the internet. You can get it from, if you go to regional trade shows or conferences or meetups are really popular now, or people at local code schools if you're a developer, you can get a sense of what they're making. So I'm involved in the Orlando devs community, which is several hundred, maybe 1,000 or more developers that work in the Orlando area. They can talk about, do you know what entry-level devs are making that are Ruby on Rails developers or iOS app developers? they can get a sense of that in their local region, the Orlando or the Southeast and Florida area. And the last one is, if you're considering a specific role at a specific company, trying to get as much information you can about that company and how they pay, say, junior developers with the experience that you have. Maybe you know somebody who works at that company, or you know a hiring manager there, or you can find information on Glassdoor.com, or PAYSA, P-A-Y-S-A.com is a great resource for this kind of thing. And so now you've narrowed it down from the entire industry in the country all the way down to the specific company that I'm looking at. And you should have a really good sense of, you know, what can I expect to make at the company that I'm considering with my skill set and experience? So that's my process in a nutshell.
But you were also saying that a person should look at their own skills, their capabilities, and estimate them. And in your book, I believe you were talking about being rigorously honest, or it was something really honest. And I was looking at it going, no. You were going into an interview to sell yourself. You were there to present yourself in the best possible light. If you happen to know X but not Y, then you focus on X and you ignore Y. You don't kind of say, well, I know this and I don't know that. That's, in my view, that's not what helps. It's to sell yourself. And I've spoken with another gentleman in this kind of field. He's more technical, but he's also a trainer, John Sonmez. And his attitude is, ask for the moon and see where you land, and sell yourself as best as you possibly can.
Yeah. So, first, I think everything you said, I think we actually totally agree. And also John is, I know John, I'm very familiar with Simple Programmer. His stuff is really great. I like the way that he approaches this as well. I think, you know, what you described is actually how I would approach it, which is, to be honest, but also to use positioning, as I mentioned earlier. So if you're really good at X, you don't want to tell them explicitly that you're not good at Y. Really, the job is to say, well, I'm good at X. X will benefit them. How will it benefit them? And how can I communicate in the interview? And so that comes down to what I call positioning, which is where you would do some research on the company, understand what makes them tick, what their goals and their challenges are, and then emphasize that your experience with X can help them to reach those goals or address those challenges. You may not ever mention Y. Obviously, if you're asked outright, are you experienced with Y? Are you good with Y? You should be honest about that. If you lie about that, that could get you into trouble. But I don't see any reason to sort of emphasize things or even bring up subjects where you're not as strong. In the same way that the company is probably doing the same thing, right? Like, they're not going to tell you, we used to have a ping pong table, but we killed it, right? Or whatever their benefits are. We used to have a really great 401k match, but we killed it. Like, they're not going to tell you about their deficiencies probably. So in the same way, you should do that. You're both sort of putting on your best face. And so I think that we agree there. I think that you want to, personally estimate your value relative to everyone else as honestly as you can. And then, just as you mentioned, John says, you know, ask for the moon, go in there and put on your best face, sell yourself the best you can, which means finding your attributes that will benefit the company in the ways they will benefit the company and playing those up in the interview so that you get a good job offer. So I think we're in alignment there.
That leads us very nicely on to the next topic, the interview, and how people prepare and the various stages of it.
Yeah, so I think we've covered, you know, quite a bit of how to prepare. I think the broad preparation is extremely important, maybe the most important part of interviews. There are two main ways that I think you need to be prepared. One is the positioning item that I mentioned earlier, which is doing research on the company to understand specifically what they're bringing in an engineer to do or a developer to do. And how your skill set and experience can help them. And half of the ball game here is literally just doing the research. So going on their website, looking at their mission statement, if they're a public company, reading, you know, just the first page of their financial disclosures, their quarterly and annual financial disclosures for the SEC, you can learn a lot about their goals and pain points there. And just understanding what their company is really focused on and communicating to them that you understand that and that you can help with it. If you just do that, you will immediately set yourself apart from all these other people who just spray resumes out everywhere and just take interviews one at a time. And they don't. I've literally interviewed people as a hiring manager in my previous life, where I could be talking to someone and realize that they didn't know what job they were interviewing for at that moment, and they may not even know the name of the company if I had stopped and said, "What's the name of the company that you're interviewing at right now?" That's not a good sign. So you want to do the opposite of that. You want to go in totally prepared and really prep for that interview with that company, and maybe even that person if you can, depending on what you can learn about them on LinkedIn and things, so that you can really position yourself to excel. The second area where you should prepare is a sneaky salary negotiation tactic that comes up really early on. I call it the dreaded salary question, or you could call it the salary expectations question. And that is, you know, sometimes before you even get your first interview, you'll be asked, what's your current salary and what do you want to make if you come on board with us? You need to be prepared for this and not disclose that information. So this is a place where I advocate honesty, but your honest answer is, I'm not comfortable sharing that with you. And you shouldn't be comfortable sharing that information because it's not time to have that conversation yet. You want to defer the salary conversation as long as possible for reasons that we talked about earlier. So let me jump back to salary structures. Let's say that they're considering you for a junior developer position. They've got a salary and range in mind for that position. If you disclose your salary requirements or expectations up front, they'll basically make a binary decision about whether you fall into that range or not and how much they think they should pay you to do the job. If you don't disclose that information, then it's still an open question exactly where you fall in that range, or it might even be an open question if they should hire you to that specific job or maybe consider a more senior job based on the answers that you give. And so you want to sort of kick that can down the road as long as possible to give yourself an opportunity to use all the research you did, the positioning expertise you're bringing to the table, to sell yourself, as you mentioned, to convince them to make you a stronger offer and push themselves to the higher part of the range or even possibly consider you for a more senior position. So preparation is do research on the company so that you can use positioning to stand out in your interview, to be the candidate that they want to hire, and then also prepare by just getting ready and kind of steeling yourself to not disclose your current or desired salary so you can defer that conversation to later, which the combination of those two will result in more job offers for you, better job offers for you, and more room to negotiate those better job offers when the time comes later on.
One tactic I've seen companies use around the salary question is it'll give you a form, a formal job application, job history, unemployment periods, do you have any convictions, and salaries. And it might be a website or it might be a paper thing, but they'll insist on something. Now, I have in the past put in zero or none of your business or whatever it happens to be. What's your advice on that?
You just gave it.
Okay.
I think it isn't any of their business. I was on a podcast recently and they were telling me a story about someone who was asked not only for that information, but for like actual pay stubs and W-2 information. And I'm not going to do it now, but I got really fired up because I said, that is not any of their business. You're not asking the recruiter for their W-2. I'm not asking you what your salary is. And so I don't think it's any of their business. The tactic that you mentioned, as far as I know, works very well, even for online forms. Mm-hmm. My recommendation for online forms is first, just try to submit the form. I'm talking to developers, right? So they may not be validating the input on that form for that field. So just hit submit and see if it goes through. Maybe it will with a blank field. Or now I'm talking to developers. You know how to defeat a field that has some sort of, you know, weak validation on it, right? It needs three digits and they have to be numerical. Okay, so you put in 000 or 999 or something, right? And so I think you either leave it blank and submit it or you just put a bogus number in there. Then once you've submitted that form, they might come back to you and just ask you personally what I call the dreaded salary question. And now you're off to the races in terms of the same advice that I just gave. So I've been giving this advice for over a year to lots of different people that I coach and on podcasts, and I've never had anyone come back to me and say, that didn't work for me. So that's still my advice until until further notice.
So I will add one other way you can avoid this, and it's a perfectly legitimate way. Quite often in a contract with your current company or a previous company, it says you are not allowed to disclose your salary. And I have been at times part of layoffs. And in your separation agreement, it still says you are bound by the terms of your previous contract. So if you have someone who is incredibly pushy, you can use that you are legally not allowed to. And then, you know, what, get a lawyer, you know, it's
right.
If they're that pushy, there's probably something bad anyway, or something smells incorrect.
Yeah. So I actually just spent last week. I had the little section for my book on the dreaded salary question, which I think is like 800 words. And I think it's good. And I've been getting so many questions about this, and it comes up on every podcast that I do, every talk that I give. This is the thing that people hit immediately in the Q&A because they're not. It makes people very uncomfortable to withhold this information, and I understand why. But in the new version of the article, which went from 800 words to 3,500 words, so I quadrupled the information that I wrote on this topic, that's the trump card at the end. It's basically saying a little different version, but I'm not comfortable sharing proprietary information for my current employer because I still work for them. And I know they would not like me sharing that information. So in your case, you might actually say, I'm contractually prevented from doing this. I will be violating a contract if I share that information from you. But even just saying, I'm not comfortable with it because it's their proprietary information. I don't want to share that with you because it's their information. I still work for them. And I'm sure that you wouldn't want me sharing that information about your employees with other people. And so what you do is, I call it your trump card, right? That's the last one. And the reason is, if they continue to push after you've raised that objection, as you just said, I now would ask my clients to think about, do you want to work for a company who you've told them that you have ethical qualms with sharing information with them, and they continue to push you to essentially violate sort of an ethical stand that you've taken. And I think, you know, I can't answer this for you, but for me, the answer is, boy, if not a hard no, I'm real concerned now. Because if they're this sort of fast and loose with ethics when they're interviewing someone, what happens when they've hired me? Right? How will they treat me as a person? How are they going to be treating my coworkers? So I like the way that you phrase that. And I think that's the kind of, you know, it's very heavy handed, right? It's proprietary information, all these big kind of legal sounding words, and which this obviously is not legal advice, but it's heavy and it usually ends the conversation. I don't think it will go past that.
You know, I think what a lot of people forget is that it's not personal either. This is a job interview. This is a professional interaction, and you're going to move on one way or the other. And one of those ways is potentially negotiating salary. So let's say the interview has gone well and there's a tentative offer and you're at the point of negotiating. What happens?
Okay. So I'm going to sort of presuppose a couple of things now, and I'll lay them out. First is that you didn't disclose your salary requirements because you listened to this podcast. And so that's a blank slate. The second is that you set your minimum acceptable salary, which I alluded to earlier, which is based on your market value estimate and also very subjective things like how interested you are in the job. Do you have to commute 5 days a week and you didn't used to? How challenging will it be? What's the long-term impact on your career? All these things. So you're just picking a number and saying, I will not accept a job for less than your minimum acceptable salary. So you've got that number kind of in your back pocket. It's not a public number. I do recommend that people literally write it down, because once you put it in writing, it's a little bit harder to fudge it and kind of go back and revise it in your head. So you're going in, you get a tentative offer, you've not disclosed your current or desired salary, and you know what your line in the sand is, what the minimum is that you will accept. Now you have everything that you need to negotiate. So the first thing you do is ask for time to consider it. You're doing that, one, to consider it, but two, so that you can kind of regroup, and now you're going to formulate your counteroffer, because you will counteroffer 100% of the time. And my recommendation is that you're going to counter between 10 and 20% above their offer. So you'll, by the way, I realize this number seems arbitrary, but if you realize that we're still floating, right? So they're not making you an offer based on your current salary, for example. They're making you an offer based on what their salary structure looks like and how they slot you into that salary structure. And so their offer is probably going to be a good offer, because they're now in the mindset, because you use positioning, they want to bring you on board. You convince them that you're the right candidate. So you can assume to a reasonable extent that the offer they make you is somewhere in the top end of the range that they're willing to pay you, and probably that it has some buffer on top of that in case you negotiate. So that's the setup. So you're countering 10 to 20% above that offer, and your 10% is basically you don't have any indication that they're desperate to hire you, or you're desperate to get the job. So you don't want to put up too much of a fight, but you're still putting up a 10% or more fight. 20% is you sense from your interviews, which, by the way, this is why you defer that salary conversation. Maybe some of the hiring managers have said to you something like, you're the perfect candidate for this job, or you've learned that the job that you're interviewing for was just suddenly vacated by somebody who got promoted or left the company 3 weeks ago, and they're desperate to fill this position to keep being productive, right? And so you would then counter higher because you've got more leverage in that situation. So you counter closer to 20%. The way that I recommend that you counter your 10 to 20% is in an email. And I'll share a link to this email template. I've got it on my site. In fact, it's by far the most popular page on my site. And I think when you see it, you'll see why. And it walks you through, here are the different components that you need to counteroffer. Here's how you make your case along with your counteroffer. And then you send that email. The reason you're sending the email to counteroffer is you want to make your case along with your counter. So you're not just countering 15%. You're saying, I'm countering 15% above your offer because reasons X, Y, and Z. And you want to make sure that whoever needs to decide if they can accommodate your counteroffer or some counteroffer, you want them to see your version of your case. And the best way to make sure that happens is to put it in writing, send it to the recruiter or hiring manager you're working with, so they can literally forward it to people in finance or other hiring managers or practice directors who need to make decisions. The bottom line is you're going to make your case better than anybody else will make it for you. And so if you put it in writing, you have a better shot at getting them to see your explanation for why you're the ideal candidate and why you're countering. So now you've got your minimum, you've countered 10 or 20% above their offer, you've sent that counteroffer. Now you need to switch gears and begin preparing for what I call the final discussion, which is almost always what will happen is you'll send this email. That day or the next day, you'll get an email back from the recruiter or hiring manager you work with, and they'll say, oh, thanks a lot for your consideration. Do you have some time to talk? And so they're going to move this to a phone call. It's a very, very short phone call. That's why I call it the final discussion. I want to make it sound a little ominous because this is where you've done all the heavy lifting. You've counteroffered. That's great. Most people don't do that. You haven't disclosed your salary requirements. That's great. Most people will do that. And now you have an opportunity to hear how they respond to your counteroffer and continue negotiating to either increase your salary a little bit more, or this is where we get into non-salary benefits like vacation time or a signing bonus or relocation bonus or sometimes equity, RSUs, all that good stuff now comes up. And so you want to have a script ready to go. So when you have this 5 or 6 minute phone call, you literally have a piece of paper in front of you that says, I countered at 75,000. If they come back at 74,000, I'm going to accept that. I'm fine with that. If they come back at 68,000, here's what I'm going to say. First, I'm going to say, can you come up to 72,000? And if they say yes, we're done. If they say no, I'll say, okay, thanks for coming up to 70. And I wanted 72 or 75 or whatever the counter was. Can you do 70 plus an extra week of paid vacation? That would mean a lot to me, right? And so that's where you start doing that final discussion. It's ironic because this is probably the shortest conversation you'll have in your negotiation or interview process, but there's the most value on this one call because you can continue to increase your salary by thousands or sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, depending on where you are. And also you can get another week of vacation or you can get a $10,000 signing bonus and things like that if they're available. And then once you finish that discussion, now you're finished. You've got your salary package, your comp package is locked up, you've negotiated and you have a job offer and you kind of move into the, you know, figuring out your starting date and all those little details. So that's my soliloquy on the salary negotiation process.
I think often people forget that this is not, again, personal. It's adversarial to some degree. You're trying to get more money. They're trying to keep more money. But by the time you start on day one, it's all forgotten. And quite often the person you're negotiating with is not the person that you directly work for. It may not even be a person in your chain of command or whatever you call it. It may well just be a recruiter who is skilled at this.
Right. Yeah, that's their job. The recruiter is not only skilled, that's literally their job.
They do it all day and they have the advantage. Yes. Another thing people often forget as well, that if they're out of work, they think that they're in a weaker position and therefore they might accept less. But the company does not know your position. You may well have a ton of savings. You may be out of work by choice. So again, I think your advice holds even if you're not, I don't know what the word would be. If you're eager to get back to work, you should still hold to your guns and demand what you think you're worth and what you can get.
Absolutely. And actually, this came up recently. I hadn't really thought of it in this context, but on a different interview that I did, somebody asked me about that. And I realized I'm an example of what you just said, which is I finished my MBA in 2011. Literally the Monday after I graduated MBA school, I went into work because I was doing a part-time program, so I was still working full-time. That the next day I went in and put in my 2 weeks notice, quit my job to live on savings. I did that for 8 months. And the next job that I got was the biggest percentage salary increase that I got in my career. So not only am I an example of you can be out of work for 8 months, I wasn't doing anything else that I could put on my resume for that 8 months. I did productive stuff, but nothing that employers would care about. I was able to go back after 8 months totally off and negotiate, I think it was like a 27% or 30% increase over my previous salary, right? And so you could definitely do that. And again, it's because you're using positioning. It's because you're not focusing on the fact that you weren't working for the last 6 months. It's because you're focusing on, well, let me just tell you about my skills and experience and how I can help you address real problems that you have at your company right now that I'm aware of and how I'll address them. So you're 100% right that just being out of work for a while, I think it can be an asset if you use that time wisely, but it can certainly be easily passed over if you're the right candidate for the job, because they don't care if you were working the last 6 months. They care, can you come in and earn the paycheck that we're going to give you? Can you add value to our company?
There was one other thing I'd mention. I heard an interview with a CEO of a British company some years ago, and he made a very direct comment, there's nothing fair about salary. And people often forget that, I think, when they're negotiating. They want what they consider to be a fair salary, but there's nothing fair. the 40 hours that I work is not necessarily better than the 40 hours a person with less skill works, but my skills are in higher demand and therefore I can get more salary. People, I think I certainly have some friends who have sort of, I'll put it in quotes, a guilt around asking for more money.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, I haven't actually done this, but I think if you search my book for the word fair, I don't think you'll find it. And that's because, for reasons that you said, it's not about fair and unfair, it's a value exchange, it's a collaboration. And so certain skills are more scarce right now, and so they're simply more valuable, especially if those skills can be leveraged to generate, you know, real dollars for a company, for example. And that just means that they're going to make more money. I definitely have coached people and worked with people who they don't want to negotiate because they don't want to seem greedy or because they feel like it's good enough, which is fine. But I think it's important. I think it's a personal decision. So you may decide to do that. But what you need to realize is by not negotiating your salary, the money that you could have negotiated is not being donated to charity. It's going to the company's bottom line. Or, you know, maybe they're using it to put a new snack machine on the third floor or whatever.
Or someone who negotiated better than you.
Or somebody who negotiated better than you. Whereas if you really feel that way and you feel guilty because you make so much money, negotiate a higher salary, earn more money from that company, and donate it to charity. Or do something you know with it that you feel is socially useful. Because chances are your decision to use that extra money to do something useful will be different than the company would have, and most likely will be less sort of, you know, profit driven or, you know, reinvesting in a company and more focused on something that matters to you. So use it as an opportunity to earn more money and do something that matters to you with it.
For a person who's changing jobs, so they are working job A, they've been interviewing for job B, they've gotten job B, you have advice on how to leave company A?
I do. And I added this just because I really think some people get uncomfortable with that part of the conversation. I think it's not rocket science. I think this might be the shortest chapter in my book. I'm not positive about that. But the basic idea is that you want to leave the company. So there's that bridge there that can be awkward where you say, okay, well, how do I put in my 2-week notice? How do I continue to interact with coworkers that I'm going to miss or that I feel like could be mutually beneficial, you know, later on in my career? And so, you know, the short version is, one, wrap up all of your responsibilities. Make sure that you're thinking very much about the person who might come behind you and take the job that you're leaving, and set them up for success right away. This is, one, just a good thing to do, but two, will reflect really positively on you. And at least in the industries that I've worked in so far, they seem like big industries, but it turns out they're really small. I continue to bump into people that I know from 10 years ago. I have a friend who is in the same office space that I'm in. She works for a company that would have been a competitor for one of my old companies. And she's constantly telling me that, oh, we just hired so-and-so. And I know that person from 8 years ago, right? There's the same people just sort of buzz around in industries. And so when you leave a company, you should be thinking very long-term about, how do I leave on the best possible terms? How do I make sure I leave a good impression on everybody that I've worked with? How do I set the next person who comes behind me up for success? Because there's a good chance that one of those people that's in that circle that you're leaving now could be a future reference for you or a future opportunity provider for you in finding, you know, your next job 4 years from now. And so it's altruistic, I think, a little bit. You want to treat people well and set them up for success. But it's also just savvy career management to make sure that you're not burning bridges when you leave. Just because you really wanted to get out of there, you have to push that impulse down to sort of, you know, burn the bridge on the way out, treat people well and move on. And you'll be surprised how often you'll bump into those same people 5 years from now. And they might have a job offer for you that may not have come up if you've been a jerk when you left your company.
I think an even more awkward discussion than the exiting one is if you want to stay, but you want more money, and you have advice on tackling that too.
I do. I think, you know, so that's a different conversation where, and this is, I like that I'm on the No Dogma podcast because there are some things that I say I'm dogmatic about. So I'm dogmatic that you should not disclose your current or desired salary, dogmatic that you should counteroffer. In terms of things that I'm less dogmatic about is sort of how you approach that. So I'm more in opinion territory here, but I think that the value-based discussion that we've already had in terms of if you want to earn more money at your company, I think it's wise to have a straight-up value-based discussion with your manager, which is, here's the research that I've done, here's the salary that I think is appropriate for the work that I'm doing, and here is sort of a list of the valuable additional work that I'm doing that wasn't anticipated last time my salary was set. And so this is another instance where I focus very much on collaboration, in that you're going to your manager and you're saying, let's sit down and talk about this. As opposed to, I am very often asked, well, shouldn't I just go out and get another job offer and then go back to my manager and tell them I have this other job offer and ask them to give me a raise? I think that could be an effective tactic. I don't particularly like it because we get out of sort of tactical salary, you know, engineering feeling stuff into more what I call meta stuff, which is career, high level career stuff, which is if you were that hiring manager and someone came to you and said they had another job offer and kind of pushed you to give them a raise to keep you, how would you feel about that person the next day? And at the very least, my guess is you would feel skittish about them. You would be concerned that, you know, well, they did that once. How long until they do it again? Are they constantly looking? And so I think that it changes the work dynamic to such an extent that you may miss out on future opportunities. It may be harder for you to really integrate with that team that you're working with and work well, as opposed to a collaborative approach where you don't bring in that outside offer and you say, look, I just want to talk to you about the value that I'm adding to this group and see if I can be compensated for some of that value. Here's my case for that. Let's talk about a raise for me and the timeline for making that happen.
Companies often have schedules, you know, pay raises in June or whatever it happens to be. If a person is in the company and they're getting their pay raise in June, but it's not at the level they want, I know you're saying, you know, make your case, but companies will often say, well, look, this is what we're doing, 2.2% this year. That's it across the board. Anything one can do there?
Oh, definitely. So I think you really, that's not a good time to try and get what I call a big raise or an exceptional raise, right? And the reason is, I recently, for my mailing list, I recently wrote a story about this and I like it, so I'm going to tell it now. So when I was a little kid, I remember very clearly the first time that I ever saw a Nintendo. So now I'm dating myself. I saw Super Mario Brothers and it blew my mind. I had only seen Atari before that. And immediately I knew that I had to have a Nintendo. So I went home to my dad and I said, Dad, I want a Nintendo for Christmas. This is a couple months out from Christmas. And he said, okay, well, we'll see what we can do. And so I thought for sure I was getting a Nintendo at Christmas. It's the only thing I wanted. I wanted it so badly. And then Christmas morning came and we opened all the presents under the tree and there was no Nintendo. And my dad could tell, you know, I was devastated. You know, little Josh didn't get his Nintendo. And Dad said, well, we just couldn't do it this Christmas. We didn't have enough money to go around. But let's think about it for your birthday. And my birthday was 3 months away in March, right? And so sure enough, I waited and my birthday came and I got a Nintendo. And the reason was that the difference between what I call your Christmas budget and your birthday budget. So what you described earlier was your Christmas budget. Everybody has got to get something. And if we leave anybody out, they're going to be really, really hurt and very frustrated. So everybody gets 2.2%. If you're lucky, maybe you get 2.4 and somebody else gets 2.0, right? And it all has to sort of balance out. And most managers, as on a personal level, are just not comfortable shafting someone on a raise unless they've just been drastically underperforming. So they're very unlikely to just take a bit, you know, take somebody's full 2.2 and give it to you so you get 4.4. They're just not going to do it. So what you do is you wait for your birthday budget. You wait until all that stuff is settled and you can go back later on and say, I'd like to talk about an off-cycle raise. Here's why. I'd like this amount. Here are the reasons, the value that I'm adding that wasn't anticipated when my salary set. Can we talk about this? And most likely, there's a process that your company can follow to grant that sort of off-cycle raise, what I call your birthday budget, when you're not competing with everyone else for a fixed pie. So that's my recommendation in that case, is if you have what is called a focal process, everybody goes at the same time for reviews and merit increases, that's not the best time to ask for a raise. Maybe a time to mention to your manager that you'd like to talk about that later. And then 6 months later, that's when you really present your case and say, I'd like an exceptional raise. Here's why. Can we make this happen?
Fantastic advice all around. Any final notes before we wrap up for the morning, Josh?
No, I don't think so. I think we did a great survey of my book, Fearless Salary Negotiation, here. And I hope, you know, I hope some folks hear some things that maybe they can take and start applying, you know, right now to their jobs and their careers.
Just a reminder of the website, and I'll put links in the post, but in case someone doesn't look at the post,
your website is? Website is fearlesssalarynegotiation.com. And I have tons of articles and I'll share some links with you. Just not, you know, yes, you can buy my book and coaching and all that good stuff there, but there are tons and tons and tons, you know, hundreds of pages of articles that are free that you can read, 180 pages. So not quite 200 days, but a lot of stuff that you can just read anytime you want. So go check it out and reach out to me if you have questions. I'm at Josh Doody on Twitter is probably the easiest way to reach me.
Josh Doody, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. I really appreciate it. We'll be right back.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Celestials by Mean Moon from the album Explorers 2.